You want to ask me questions, or how do you want to handle it?
Well, let me just go ahead and put on the record first. Today's date is March the 14th. Today's date is March the 11th.
Wednesday, March, yeah, 10 o'clock, Dale there. Wednesday, March 11th.
And the time is, it's 1981, the time is 10 o'clock, and we're in Bartow. And my name is Dale Durrance, I'm a county judge in Polk County, and I'm interviewing Marshall H. Edwards, an attorney at law, practicing attorney in Bartow. And have you had a chance to fill out this questionnaire, all of these?
I haven't received that.
You hadn't received one of those?
No, I got your questions, taped interview, tentative.
Okay.
But I'll be happy to fill this out for you.
Let me give you one of those, and you can just fill out those. Those are just some preliminary questions we want to preserve based on just some aspects of your own personal and educational and military and professional background.
I can look at these questions and start answering them.
Is that
you'd like to do?
Yes, sir. That'd be fine.
Okay.
But I'll leave this questionnaire with you so you can.
I haven't got that before. I'll be happy to fill it out.
You just go ahead and.
All right. I stated my name is Marshall H. Edwards. I came to Polk County during the summer of 1923. At that time, I graduated from the University of Illinois, which. And had a employment with Chapman, Cutler, and Parker, a firm of bond attorneys in Chicago. And during the summer months, when I was going to high school, I worked for Harry Chapman, who was county judge in Jersey County, Illinois. And while working for Harry Chapman, I met his brother, T.S. Chapman, who had formed the firm of Chapman, Cutler, and Parker in Chicago, and I studied law at Illinois solely for the purpose of practicing law with this organization. It was a great opportunity for a young lawyer. However, right after World War I and in 1919, my father, mother, and older brother made a trip to Florida. While here, I more or less fell in love with this state and thought that sometime I might like to live here. My salary with Chapman, Cutler, and Parker at that time was to be $125 a month. Do you want this much detail?
Oh, yeah. We want to preserve any of those.
You can kick any of it out. It would be $125 a month, which was quite complimentary, because at that time, the sons of rich parents were paying top law firms for the privilege of their son to practice law. However, I didn't like the idea of spending my life in Chicago. My dad, who had studied law and was a lawyer, told me, and I remembered well, said, "Well, you do what you want to, Marshall. But if I was a young man, I'd go in a new country and grow up with it." So I suppose that was the motive that I had when I came to Polk County. As I said, when I came here some 4 years before then, but I was still going to university, and right after World War I, and we traveled around the state, our family, and we all fell in love with it pretty much. So I came here in 1923. There in the summer months. At that time, the officers in Polk County, I think you wanted this information, where John Logan was sheriff, John S. Edwards was circuit judge, Spencer L. Holland was county judge, J.D. Rollison was clerk of the court, J. Perry Mordahl was tax collector, and Werner G. Jones was tax assessor. When I got down here, I found out that since I hadn't practiced law in Illinois for 5 years, it was necessary for me to take the bar examination. And I found out that the first time I could take the bar was in October of 1923. And at that time, you had to take the bar before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court consisted then of six men. And each justice had you for half of the day. And I recall very well my experience. This might be interesting. When I was up there, I met, of course, all the justices and took the bar examination. I'm trying to think a minute. Judge Glenn Terrell, had just been appointed to the Supreme Court. And he was a long, tall, very friendly sort of a fellow. He'd been a school teacher turned lawyer. And Terrell was one of the judges, and as I said, had just been appointed. I found the bar examination in Florida very, very easy. I had the advantage of a full legal education in that I had 2 years of pre-legal at the University of Illinois and 3 years of law. And most of the Florida lawyers at that time just had at the most 2 years with no pre-legal. So among the younger lawyers in Florida at that time, I had the advantage of having a longer legal education than any of them had.
Was the exam that they conducted, the interviews, was it strictly oral questions?
Or no, it was all written.
All written?
It was all written. And I remember that this incident was rather, and I related to show what a kindly individual Judge Terrell was. I was usually the first one to get through up there. As I said, to me it was very easy bar examination. And I was usually the first one to get up, and I found out that I was known as a young guy from Chicago who always got through first. So anyway, I turned in my paper and walked out. Some of the judges would stay in all during the time, but Judge Terrell, he'd walk in and out and give you the impression that you were on your own and he wasn't supervising you or interested in that. So as I walked out, the judge said to me, "What's the matter, young man? Did you find it too difficult?" He thought I'd thrown in the sponge. And I said, "No, Judge, I'm through." He said, "Well, what's your name?" I said, "My name is Edwards." He said, "Where are you from?" And I told him I was a graduate of the University of Illinois, and so forth and so on, why I came down here. He said, "Well, I can understand now why you found it rather easy. I think I can understand that." He said, "By the way, the secretary to the governor is named Edwards, and would you like to meet him?" And I said, "Yes, that would be quite a privilege, Judge." So anyway, this man then walked all the way from the old Supreme Court building over to the Capitol and introduced me to, I think his name was Callie Edwards, who was then secretary. So anyway, we talked, and Judge Terrell said to me, "Well, I'm sure you'll have no trouble passing the bar, and you'll be coming up here. And whenever you come on, I want you to come see me. And don't make any difference whether before my division or not, I want you to come see me." So that was the beginning of a long friendship that I had with Judge Terrell in particular. And as the years went by, George Garrett from Orlando, who opposed me in many cases before the Supreme Court, and who I represented one time in a civil action against American fruit growers, he was also a great friend of Judge Terrell's. And oftentimes, several times we went out to the judge's house and spent the evening with him. And I found him to be one of the most interesting, lovable individuals I ever knew. That's just a bit of a sideline.
Justice Terrell. Yeah.
Was really a great guy. And I have his book, you know, Sayings of Judge Terrell, and I, of course, read it with much interest. Oh, let's see. What was your first legal experience as a lawyer? Well, then when I came back to Bardo, after I passed the bar examination, before going, Polk County and Bartow and Florida in general during the summer months were very dull. That summer, when I decided not to go back up north, my father and mother were then living in Springfield, Illinois, and my brother was in Chicago, worked working for Western Electric. He contemplated getting married that fall, and that probably changed my plan because we would no longer live together in Chicago. And my dad was working for Internal Revenue in Springfield, and there wasn't much reason for me to go back. So that summer, I worked in Spencer Holland's office as county judge. I tried to find tentative employment here with the various lawyers in Bartow, but could find none. So I had journeyed over to Tampa and had a tentative offer of a job with Whitaker, Hines & Whitaker in Tampa and Lane & Bussey in St. Petersburg, and I had planned to go there. Well, then when I came back after, during the summer and after I'd passed the bar examination, Holland told Huffaker that he thought I was had a prospect and he better hire me if he could. So the growth of all that, Huffaker hired me in January of 1924, and I worked for him for a year. And Huffaker, as I said, had been a school teacher. He was principal of the schools in Bartow and had studied law for 1 year at the University of Florida. That was his background. But he was quite proud of his achievement and had reason to be. And when I went up there, he told me, quite frankly, that he never intended to change the name of his firm or his individual practice. He felt he had built an individuality around that and didn't want to change it. And I told him I understood it quite well. And I would like to come up there and get a bit of experience. Although I had my last year up in Illinois, I had done trial work. And we also had moot court, and I liked trial work. Huffaker didn't like it. So I guess that's why he was interested in me. I remember the second day that I was in Huffaker's office, he had a case for trial down in Arcadia. And then we went on the train. So I got ready to prepare the case. And I went down to Arcadia to try the lawsuit. And this was interesting in that George Whitehurst had just been appointed circuit judge, and the lawyer on the other side was Fairfax T. Haskins from Sebring. And it was my first case. I think this is, you asked for that interview. Yeah. So I went down there, and it was interesting in that it was the first case for the judge and for both of the lawyers. So we had quite a time.
was that tried in Arcadia?
Tried in Arcadia in the old courthouse, which is still there. So anyway, that you asked me what... all right, why'd you come to Pocan to practice law? What was your office? Well, when Huffaker and I started... Huffaker's office, where I went there in January of 1924, was over what was the old State Bank. The old State Bank of Bartow, which is on the corner where the present Florida First National Bank is built. And that was Huffaker's office. Of course, I went up there. And we just had three offices, and we were very crowded. And across the hall was Luke Johnson and Leonard Boynton and Harry Taylor. So we were all very crowded. So anyway, in 1924... that's where I was, and that's where the office was. Then in 19...
You worked for Mr. Huffaker?
I worked, well, I'll get on back to that. I worked for Huffaker for a year. And at the end of the year, I had 10 offers of partnership, as I remember.
How were you paid by Mr. Huffaker? Was it,
I started out $100 a month, I think, for a month. And about that time, along in 24, about that time, the boom started. And lawyers were very much in demand. And they started going from starvation situations to making big money. And, this thing could go on and on and on. But anyway, they started making big money. I think I worked for Huffaker for a month for $100, and I was putting on the books several $1,000s a month. We were doing most of the title work. The real estate practice came along. We were going contracts and forming corporations, handling closings and so forth. It's a big real estate practice. And it was lucrative. I kept on then, Huffaker kept stepping me up And finally, at the end of the year, I don't recall now what I was paying, but I had an offer from Callaway and Burris. I had several offers, 10 offers of partnership. Callaway and Burris was perhaps the leading law firm over in Lakeland. They represented that Cleveland concern that came down and developed Cleveland Heights and built the clubhouse, which is now the yacht club there on the lake. And Callaway was quite, Callaway was one of the few Republicans, but he had quite a following and was a good getter. And his partner was Burris. At that time, the other leading law firms in Lakeland was Carver and Langston. They offered me a partnership, Carver and Langston. And then Tom Tranum's father, Sim Tranum, Brian Tranum, was a leading law firm. This may be interesting. When I came to Bardo, as I remember, there were 33 lawyers in Bardo. There was more lawyers in Bardo than there were in Lakeland. The only lawyer now living in Lakeland that was here then is Tom Bryant, who's way up in his 90s, I think. He's older than I know. As I say, when I came to Bardo, there were 33 lawyers, and they're all gone now. And Bradley Wilson was the last of the 33, and Bradley's been dead about 20 years. So all those lawyers who were here then have passed on. Over in Winter Haven, there were about three lawyers. Don Register was there then. Abe Sumlin was there then. And a few more, but there weren't very many lawyers. I don't think there was any lawyers in Haines City. John Newell's father came there from Jacksonville about that time in the early 20s. Then as the boom came along, the lawyers began to come in from other states and so forth. And law became more lucrative at that time. Well, anyway, I remember after I told Mr. Huffaker that at the end of the month I was going to go with Callaway and Burris, he congratulated me and told me that, of course, that he didn't want to stand in the way of a young man progressing. And so that was the plan. Well, then the next morning, he came in and said that he and Mrs. Huffaker had discussed the matter, and they had decided that if other people could offer me a partnership, they could too. So I went into Huffaker on a fourth partnership, probably in 25. I think it was June the 1st, 1925, after having been there about a year, on a fourth partnership. Callaway and Burris had offered me a fourth partnership and a guarantee of $10,000 for the first year, which was a sizable sum of money for a young lawyer at that time. Anyway, Huffaker said he wouldn't offer me any guarantee, but he'd give me a fourth partnership. And I recall that first year, I made something over $9,000 for my fourth, which means Huffaker made three times that much. But I didn't quite make the $10,000. But we practiced. Then, of course, as time went on, my interest in the firm of Huffaker and Edwards increased, and we became one of the old law firms in the county, and I wound up, I found myself in the long in the 30s doing 80-85% of the work and only getting half of the money. And so Mr. Huffaker decided he'd run for circuit judge and did against Don Register and D.O. Rogers. And he was defeated. And at that time, in 1940, I dissolved the partnership, and since that time resisted all offers of partnership and practiced alone until I retired some 3 years ago. John S. Edwards, as I said, was circuit judge, and he wasn't making as much money as the lawyers, so John Edwards decided that he would get into law practice and resign as circuit judge. Then H.C. Petaway was appointed. That's Gordon Petaway's half-brother. H.C. Petaway was about a third or fourth rate, as we lawyers rated him, a lawyer in Lakeland at that time. And everybody was more or less surprised that he got the appointment. Well, he turned out to be one of our very best circuit judges. He learned. he learned, as the lawyers carried the law to him, he had a good mind, but he was basically lazy. But he made an outstanding circuit judge, and was perhaps one of the best circuit judges that we ever had in Polk County. Then the boom didn't last long, and she blew up. And it started in 24, 25, 26, and then it started to blow up. And when it did blow up, it did a good job of blowing up. All the banks in Polk County, save only the state bank in Lake Wales, closed. There wasn't any money. The practice of law became more or less a barter system. If you did a foreclosure, the practice changed from real estate transaction to mortgage foreclosure and bankruptcy, and so forth and so on. Private practice. What? Oh, Huffer and I did a general practice. I used to have a saying that if a man came to my office and had a legitimate case in $25, I was his lawyer. I didn't care what it was. I was licensed to practice for the Treasury Department in 1923, and I did tax returns. and I did tax practice until it became so complicated that I quit doing my own and hired a specialist in that field. I did criminal practice. I'll get back. When I came here in 1923, they created the Criminal Court of Record. And old Judge Oliphant, he was quite a distinguished old jurist at that time, and he became judge of the Criminal Court of Record. And he was well-liked and well-thought of.
What about the courtroom demeanor? And dress code? Was there a dress code that attorneys had to
abide? In the beginning, you went to court with a coat and tie in Polk County. Of course, in federal court, it's always been formal. Of course, I practiced law from Duval and Jacksonville to Duval to Miami. I did a lot of practice in Hillsborough County, and we practiced pretty much all over the state. You know, wherever case was, you'd go, and I was pretty much familiar, particularly with Hillsborough County. Yeah, we wore coats and ties, and then when H.C. Petaway came on the bench, he was quite a character. He usually needed to shave, and he wasn't particularly concerned about his general appearance. As I stated, he had an excellent mind, was a good judge, very popular, and well-liked. And Petaway would say, gentlemen, remove your coats. And then, from about that time on, during the summer months, we went to court in our shirt sleeves. And then, I think the lawyers over on the East Coast, they started a fad of wearing sports shirts. And that went more or less all over the state, except Hillsborough County. I used to kid the lawyers over there. I used to say you could always tell a lawyer from Tampa because he was carrying a coat. He had a coat under his arm. But in the main, it became dressed with informal for a number of years until the advent of air conditioning. And once air conditioning come back, and when the judges started putting on robes, that changed the whole deal. To me, that's been rather interesting, and in some respects, rather amusing. And I remember when the Supreme Court of Florida went to robes. They were the first in the state decided they would don the old English custom of black robes. They didn't go as far as the wigs, but they did put on the robes. And I remember my good friend Glenn Terrell was very much against it, and for a long, long time would refuse to wear a black robe. He may have on occasion, but I used to smile when I would see sometimes Judge Terrell would be the only man on his division, whatever it may have been, that had on a suit. He didn't have on a robe. But that was characteristic of the man. Well, then the whole thing changed, and the lawyers began to wear coats and ties, and the judges even this judges starting putting on black robes, to me, has been more or less amusing, okay? Which is neither here nor there. All right. You ask where I started practicing law, as I said, in the old state bank building, which is later torn down, and the present bank building. They tore down the old state bank building, and they tore down the old Wilson Drug, which was next door to it, and they erected the present building. Well, in 1929, as I said, we were crowded up there. Hufker and I just had three rooms on one side of the hall, and then Lou Johnson had the office on the other side.
Did he later go to Tampa?
I'll tell you all that. Lou Johnson was the Clarence Darrow of Polk County. He was self-educated. He never went to law school. I used to kid him that Grandma Johnson, who raised him. See, Luke's daddy, was one time clerk in court, old man W.H. Johnson. And Luke's mother died. And his stepmother raised him. And they used to kid Luke that his mother, who was she was a school teacher and taught a lot of the kids in the summer, and they used to kid Luke that his mother said, My son's a necessity lawyer. That necessity knows no law. But Luke knew all that Lou, everybody was a good criminal lawyer and did a lot of trial practice. And particularly he did the trial practice for Wilson and Swearingen. When I came to Bartow's, I said before, there are 33 lawyers, and the most prominent of the 33 was old Colonel Tom Wilson. And the firm had been Wilson and Wilson. And Charlie Wilson, who was the father of Mel and Bradley and Milton, and Chester Wiggins' wife, Charlie had died about 1902. And then the firm, they got John Swearingen up here from Arcadia, and the firm became then the firm of Wilson and Swearingen. And then after Colonel Tom, when I came here, was not active. He had made quite a bit of money in bank stock and in real estate, and in his 60s was retired, but still a member of the firm, but didn't spend a lot of time in Bartow. He traveled a lot and went up to Atlanta and so forth. Anyway, they used to quote Colonel Tom as saying, Colonel Tom says this and Colonel Tom says that. They quoted Colonel Tom Wilson as though he were a member of the Supreme Court. And they used to tell a story that Colonel Tom Wilson one time represented a client and approved a title. And when the client sold the property to somebody, Colonel Tom examined the title for the purchaser and turned it down. So the client wanted to know why, and Colonel Tom explained that he knew more law when he last examined the abstract that he did before. That was a story that used to be popular going around the town. All right, in 1929, Huffaker and I moved from the old state bank building. We moved from the old state bank building to what was called the White Building, which was on Main Street, and which is now is the site of the courthouse annex. It's where the county commissioners are and where the Board of Public Instruction is. And Special Holland then quit being county judge in 1929 and started practicing law. And Holland in the meantime had offered me a partnership, but I'd stayed with Huffaker. My dad, who then lived in Lakeland, and Huffaker were both big Methodists, and they had gone to Methodist Church here. And my dad thought it would be well for me to stay with Mr. Huffaker, that after all, he had given me a job as a young lawyer, and we were getting along all right. And so I declined Spencer's offer of partnership and stayed with Huffaker. Anyway, Spencer then got a man of the name of Edwards, P.B. Edwards, who came here from Birmingham, Alabama, to practice law with him. And then about that time, he hired Beavis, W.F. Beavis. Beavis, when I came here, was a teller in the old Polk County National Bank. Beavis, as I recall, had gone to Florida 1 year and had worked as an abstractor of the old Polk County Abstract Company before he became a banker. But when I met him in 1923, he was a teller at the old Polk County National Bank, which was then on the corner of Broadway and Main Street, and is now one of the courthouse annexes. It was one of the banks that closed in 1929. Well, then Spessard hired P.D. Edwards, and he also got Beavis. And Beavis was supposed to examine the abstracts for Holland, because he had had some experience in that. So they started out a firm, and they got in there a young lawyer by the name of Robert Hughes, who was one of the outstanding young lawyers that ever come to Polk County. He was the son of Dr. Hughes, and when he was going to high school when I came here, and he couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to be a doctor and follow in his father's footsteps, or whether he wanted to be a lawyer. So his father, who had an office in this old state bank building where my office in Huffford was, asked me if I'd talk to young Robert, and of course I told him I'd be very happy to. So he came up to my office, and I spent the afternoon and showed him how lawyers worked, and how they looked up the law, and how the rule of stare decisis operated. And we began a friendship which continued all through the years. And when Holland run for governor in 1939, Bob Hughes and I had planned to form a partnership, practice law, which wasn't generally known. He wasn't too happy. It was in the firm of Holland, Beavis, and Hughes. And Bob was a trial lawyer and was really the lawyer in the firm. But he unfortunately died on October 23rd, 1939. So that ended.
Was it sudden death?
Sudden death. He had an appendicitis operation and a blood clot formed and got in his lung and died. I was at his bedside with his father when he passed away. We were on the city commission together. We were very close friends. He was almost like a younger brother to me. He was head of the military here in Bartow, and Hughes Armory down there was named after him. And as I said, he was on the city commission with me and followed me as president of the Kiwanis Club of Bartow. And of course, we were very close friends and had planned to practice law together, but that wasn't to be. So then about that time, this building burned where we are now, at 137 East Main Street. Ellis Gibson had bought it shortly before then, and it burned. I don't remember the date, but I do recall it burned the day that his daughter Mary and Leonard Blankner got married. And I kidded him afterwards that they set the town on fire. Anyway, they built this building. And I came up here one time nosing around. Ellis was up here. He said, "Well, how would you?" He said, "How about coming over here and having your offices over here?" This may be too much personal in this.
No, that's what we want.
Well, you can cut it. Well, I'm just rambling on.
That's good. You go right ahead.
Old Ellis, who was quite a character, their office was down, still on Main Street, but down about where the hardware company is now, and they rented. And I knew all of them, and I knew Ellis and Clyde and Homer, who have always been friends of all through the years. So anyway, I was up here just nosing around, you know, and Ellis said, "Well, how would you like this for an office? How about coming up here?" I said, "No." I said, "You know, George White built the White Building over there primarily for Huffaker and Spessard and Leonard Boynton Ray Jordan was the dentist, was over in the White Building, and a young doctor by the name of Lancaster. We were all over there in the old White Building." Ellis said, "No, the county's going to buy that." Ellis was the type of person that knew what was going on in the county more than anybody. So he said, "No, the county's going to buy that." He said, "Well, how would you like it?" And he had a hallway up through the middle. And I said, "Well, that's fine," but he had three offices on that side and three offices on this side. So I said, "Well, I'd want a big room from the library." You've seen the library space up here, haven't you?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Of course, you know, most of my library went to the county. I gave most of it to the county. I said, "I'd want a big room for the library." And that was about all it was said. So anyhow, The time went on, and I found out afterwards that Ellison made the change and saw me one day and said, well, your offices are ready for you. And so that was about all was said. Anyway, when it was known that we had to move, Hufker and Ellis Gibson never saw eye to eye, apparently, but of course, there was neither here nor there. Hufker had formed enemies in Bartow, like Hugh Ware and Ellis Gibson and others, you know, all through the years. It meant nothing to me. But anyway, Hufker wanted to go around where Bob Hatton had a building, around there, I think, where the supervisor registration is, across from the old Scared Abstract Company, which was there then. And I thought it was out of the way place. And I told Hufker, no, that I suggested then, that must have been in 39. Yeah, it must have been in 39. No, I mean, when the hell was it? Must have been, happen to think of it, whenever this building was built. Was it 37?
I don't know. I think, isn't there a date up on top of the building?
I don't remember. Anyway, it'll come to me pretty soon. If you reach back far enough, you can probably get it. We stayed over there, I think, 1929. We came here in 1937. In the meantime, in about 1925, Luke Johnson formed the firm of Johnson, Bosarge, and Allen. When they left the old State Bank building, they came up here, I think, on the corner. Then Hufker and I stayed here. We came over here. I suggested we, Hufker had a son in study-in-law, Rob Hufker, and I told Hufker that he naturally he'd want his son to practice law with him, and that Bartow couldn't sustain a three-man firm. Because at that time, Johnson, Bosarge, and Allen found out that they couldn't survive. It was a three-man firm. Bill Allen pulled out and went over with Bradley Wilson. John Swearingen had been killed in an automobile accident. So then Luke and Bo practiced law together, and Bill Allen went over. This was before World War II. Went over with Bradley Wilson, and they practiced for a short time over there. Then Bill and Bo had been in the Navy before, and they both went back in the Navy. And when Bill came back, he went up to Tallahassee and formed a partnership up there and practiced law in Tallahassee until he was appointed to the circuit bench, as I remember. So anyway, I dissolved the partnership in May, I think it was, of 1940, and I've stayed here ever since. And Hufker then went up over what's now the Corner Drugstore and had his office for a few years until he passed away in his 60s. So, as I said, Hufker and I did a general practice. I did criminal work for a number of years until I found out that the criminal practice in the main was repeaters, and it wasn't the most desirable practice. So I quit it, I guess, maybe 8 or 9 years, and did. In the meantime, I had started doing civil practice, mostly personal injury cases. That was before the days of working compensation. And there was more. There was a lot of cases against the railroad company, the phosphate company, and I did that too. All right, did I ever serve as a special master referee or commissioner for the courts? Yes, many times. This is interesting in that all of your chancery cases were taken before a special master. They weren't heard before a judge. All your chancery cases were referred to a special master. We had certain firms that had certain men who would serve as special master. For instance, I used Gordon Petaway a great many times. Gordon Petaway started practicing law in Bartow with Leonard Boynton and stayed there until Leonard was killed, and then Gordon left here and went over to Lakeland. But Gordon and Leonard Boynton had an office in the White Building. Yeah, all chancery cases were referred to a special master. And a special master would come in and he'd swear the witnesses. And you could put them under the rule or not as you saw fit. Usually the rules waived. All right. You took your testimony. You took your testimony in your office, so that it was necessary. It was necessary that your we used to call them stenographers, and then they later became secretaries, and then the best ones became paralegals. I had two paralegals. Miss M. Stevens worked for me 35 years, and she was definitely a paralegal. She died in 64, and I planned to quit then. I didn't think I could replace her. Emily Mann was court reporter. I had given Emily the first job she ever had when she came here from the University of Alabama. And she then became a court reporter and started to learn the stenotype system and taught them. So when Miss M passed away in February of 64, I called up Emily and told her she was going to have to come help me or send me somebody. So, because I was behind, Miss M had suffered a stroke and been in the hospital for a while. And her health had been bad for some time. So she sent me up a young lady, Mrs. Kulik. And that Kulik, or Marshall, which is fine.
Yeah.
Miss M, I was always the colonel. She never wanted to call me Marshall. Mr. Edwards was a little too formal. And she always called me the colonel. Everybody, all the old lawyers in Florida then were called Colonel. You remember that?
I don't remember.
Well, anyway, when I came to Bartow, it was Colonel Tom Wilson, it was Colonel Brady, it was Colonel Solon Wilson. All the older lawyers were called Colonel. Now, the reason for that, this is a bit of history you might want to preserve. The reason for that was that in Georgia, by statute, all members of the bar were made colonels on the governor's staff. So anyway, so many lawyers through the years came from Georgia to Florida that custom has continued on. And now it's funny, now at my age, I'm approaching 80, and I've been a member of the bar for many years, longer than most people, fortunately, with God's help and willingness. There's only one lawyer, there's two lawyers, that keep calling me Colonel. Billy Tomasello always called me the Colonel. And Mont Camel, to this day, whenever I see Mont, he always refers to me as the Colonel. So that's my name is about going out. And then Lindsay used to call me Lindsay Holland, used to call me, yeah, I've got to go see the Colonel. I don't so and so.
Oh, Lord. Special son?
Special son.
Yeah.
Yeah, I helped him get started. I've helped a lot of young men get started.
He's my uncle, Lindsay Jr.
Is he? Yeah. Well, anyway, he came here. He was with the firm for a short time and then pulled out and had an office here over on the corner. And he always used to come up to my office. And I remember one time I was standing at the foot of the office and Lindsay was coming down. He got about halfway down the stairway. And he said, "Well, I got to go see old man Edwards." And I looked and I said, "Who you calling old man?" And he laughed. He was embarrassed. I said, "It's all right. I'm old man." All right. Who was the judge? I was talking about special masters. Yeah. ...1964, after Miss M passed away. And she had been with me for 35 years. Well, in the interim, many times I had an extra secretary because I used to talk to people all day and I worked at night for about 30 years. Many a time I've had the cops knock on the door out there at 2 o'clock in the morning because the lights were still on. We worked. There was no shortage. And we didn't work on an hourly basis. We had a job to do and that was our concern. I can take an oath that I never accepted employment in a case with an idea in mind of how much I would make. I never was employed on an hourly basis in my life. I wouldn't accept employment on that basis. It's highly irregular. To illustrate, perhaps the first lease that I ever grew, I may have spent a lot of time. Maybe I spent a whole day. And during the years, I had drawn hundreds of leases. And as the years went by, if I had a lease, I would say to my paralegal, "Bring me the John Jones lease. Bring me my lease file." I had a lease file. I had a declaration file. It later became complaints. I created Edwards Farms. I never used a farm book as such. I never copied a farm from a farm book in my life. I had them all. The ones I haven't given away are here. I used them only for ideas. I never liked farms. I never liked probate farms. I never used probate farms. What I may have spent, a job I may have spent hours on, days on, in the beginning as a young lawyer, maybe it was a trust. I've drawn charitable remainder, irrevocable trust. The average lawyer now, you ask him, tell it if he ever drew an irrevocable charitable remainder trust, he wonders what you're talking about. Don't you see? Yeah. I called one time Holland Knight and talked to their probate man, John, whatever his name is, and asked him, had he ever drawn an irrevocable charitable remainder trust? He said, no, they didn't have one as a president. So anyway, you develop. So anyway, what may have in the beginning have taken me days to do became nothing more or less than a job for my paralegal to make a few changes in copy. And she, to illustrate further, I had a person I'd formerly represented after I quit practicing law. He came up and he wanted a lease. He wanted a lease drawn for one room for 6 months at $125 a month. He was representing an estate, I think. He was doing it as a kindness. And he'd been to a young lawyer and asked him what his fee would be. He'd had some astonishing experiences, I think, with other charges in state matter with this young man. And he told him that it would be roughly $250. And that he charged $50 an hour for his time, and his secretary got $17 an hour for her time. And it would be his estimate that it would be less than $250. And it would take him perhaps a better part of a day to draft it. And he says, is it worth $250? As I said, he was only rented for 6 months, I think, for $125. I said, no, it isn't worth it. He said, will you do it? I said, yeah, I'll do it. So anyway, I called then Mrs. Cooley, Jeanette, bring me the lease file. Now I want you to keep track of this. So this said, this was about 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, when can I get it? So Jeanette said, you come in right after lunch and I'll have to. So I said, Jeanette, keep time. See how long it takes us to do this. I use this to illustrate my point where it isn't fair to charge by the hour. See, you should charge by the job. It's what the service is worth, don't you see? Not how long it took. So anyway, I talked to Jeanette for 10 minutes. We made a few changes. She was an excellent paralegal. She was supposed to leave July the 1st of 64, but she stayed here 14 years. And if she hadn't left, I guess I'd still be practicing law. Anyhow, he came in after lunch, and it took us total time of 32 minutes to do the lease. Which included her typing time, because she was a whiz on a typewriter. It just blurt, 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 expert. It's fun practicing law if you've got that kind of help. But they ain't eating many of them. Of course, if I was younger, I'd steal one from somebody. But there's not too many, now that they use these Dick Trojan machines. But you can't do that because if you got a paralegal, you come in, you explain what you want done, and she does 90% of it. She does 90%. So, but back in the old days, all chancery matters were taken before special master. He came in, and he swore the witnesses, and then he left. And then your secretary, who was a court reporter, would take down the testimony. I remember Miss M. I used to marvel at it. She'd be sitting there taking shorthand, sometimes spoken, and maybe the guy who was talking spoke broken English, and she never stopped him 1 minute. She'd get it down perfect. How they did it, I don't know. But I mean, they're just experienced. Well, of course, when Jeanette came along, I quit doing trial work. I quit doing trial work when I went to Washington in the middle 50s and on advice of John Hopkins Hospital. I had a health flare up. And they told me if I wanted to live, I had to show them. So I wound up my docket and quit doing trial work in 1955. At that time, I had docketed 1,100 actions at law in Polk County. And since Polk County began at that time, there were 11,000. In 30 years, I've docketed about 10%. But it was a different ball game. It was a different ball game. It was a different profession. There were about 125 lawyers in Polk County. You knew all the lawyers on a first-name basis. You knew those you could trust, and you knew those who were damn frauds. And there wasn't too many of the latter, thank the Lord. We used to have two terms at court a year. We sound the docket in spring, and we sound the docket in the fall. We practiced law according to rule days. All your pleadings were due the first Monday of the month. That's when you filed your declaration, your plea, your rejoinder, sir rejoinder, and whatever. And under the old practice, law was a fine art. Common law pleading was a great art. When I came to Florida in 1923, there were no form books in the state of Florida. There had never been a form book written. The only two form books were Pewterball, common law pleading, and Pewterball, equity practice, both of which were Illinois form books, and which I had studied at the University of Illinois. I've still got the old Pewterball one of them came out missing. But those were the only form books. And you went by all the niceties of the common law. And the most fun in the world was to plead some guy out on the end of the limb, then shake the tree and drop him. And then, you know, that was too complicated. Common law pleading is too complicated. The only difference between the system of common law pleading in Illinois and Florida when I came here was that trespass, you had trespass on the case, you had to style the case. You had to style your cause of action. And in Illinois, if you misspelled it, and you called it trespass, and it should have been trespass on the case, you were out of court. Well, I found out much to my delight that in Florida, all you had to do was call it a civil action. Civil action damages so-and-so. See? Well, of course, it was over $500. You were in the circuit court. It was under $500. You stayed in the county court. And if it was under 100, you were in the JP court. Now, I might say in passing, young man, that the biggest mistake, and I emphasize this, the biggest mistake the state of Florida ever did, according to this old man's opinion, is when they adopted Article 5 of the Constitution. It cost this county, it's cost this state billions and billions of dollars. The state attorney, of course, there were fewer people here, but not in proportion to your cost. The state attorney's office used to be a part-time job for one lawyer. It wasn't a full-time job for one lawyer. Of course, you had your county solicitor, you had your criminal court of record, you had your JP courts where a lawyer seldom went. You had your JP cases, had some jurisdiction, misdemeanors, and so forth and so on. You had your county judge who had criminal jurisdiction up to the time of the creation of the criminal court of record. But you have different judges. You have different court systems. Now, as you probably know, the state attorney has 75 people working for him. They got 21 or 20-some-odd girls down there who are secretary. And it has become an entirely different ballgame, and it's costing the taxpayers of the state of Florida billions and billions of dollars. That's my opinion. And that opinion is shared by old lawyers in my age bracket. And I've had Jess Wilson, who was formerly a circuit judge, has told me that he's of my opinion. So forth. That's neither here nor there. All right.
Well, I think that's important for history's sake, because I may be one of the few people who, I wasn't a lawyer at the time Article 5 was adopted. I voted against it for those same ideas you're promoting now. That,
well, of course, there was the pros made a big loud bang.
It wasn't the bar that was the big pusher behind it.
It was the Florida bar, Chesterfield Smith and the Florida bar. They thought it was going to be, but Chesterfield, you know, he's been a legal politician, both in the Florida bar. He lived across the street. He lived across the street ever since he lived here, and I've known him from came up here from Arcadia. we first knew him, you know, was Harvey Smith. And he had an uncle, I think, who was Chesterfield. His uncle was in politics, and I don't think he liked being another Chesterfield. So anyway, he came up here just before World War II. When he come back, I called him Harvey. He said, no, it's Chesterfield. So I had to start calling him Chesterfield. So Holland brought him up here, you know, from Arcadia after he started to extend his, and then Chesterfield was the one pretty much, I think he was instrumental in forming all these offices all over the state, which is their business, which is fine, sure, if that's what they want to do. I've always said this, if I practice law in a city, I of necessity want to be a member of the firm. That's the way I started out, but I didn't like the setup. In Chapman, Cutler, and Parker, I found out I was number 27. And I spent all my time back in the library. Well, that might be all right, but I guess because my dad said if I was a young man, I'd want to go in a new country and grow up with it. I was born, I grew up on a farm in Central Illinois. I was a farm boy. I knew all the farm. And I had tested this thing in here, other things I've done. Yeah, I grew up on a farm. And I learned to work from can to can. The day started at 4 o'clock and it ended when you couldn't see anymore. Sometimes you did the chores by lantern. I wasn't overly bright. The biggest asset I ever had, I'd work. And what success I made as a lawyer, I guess, was because I'd work. I remember one of the last cases I ever argued before old Don registered. We'd finished the argument, sitting there just talking my opposition. I don't remember now who it was that left. And Don Register, whom I knew real well, he said, Marshall, I always enjoy your arguments. He said, you exhaust the case. You go into every angle and you exhaust them. I enjoy your arguments very much. I said, well, thank you. Thank you very much. He said, you know, they don't make lawyers like you anymore. Of course, that's complimentary and I'm blowing my own horn.
Sure. Well,
but I think that that's probably true. That's why, see, I had a tremendous library. Most all of my opposition, when I sued the coastline, I had Payne Kelly's father, opposition. Later, I had John Sutton. When I sued the Seaboard, I had A.G. Turner, Knight Thompson, and Turner, my opposition. When I sued an insurance company, without exception, I had Bob Shapperford represent the insurance company. I wouldn't represent him, because I could make more money suing him. I was in all the insurance digests and all that sort of thing. And I was offered a retainer by the Atlantic Coastline. You know what? Bradley Wilson had the retainer. They gave him about $500 a year, maybe $100 a year, and some pass privileges. That's all the poor old Bradley ever made out of the Atlantic Coastline Railway Company. Of course, the Seaboard, I think one time the Seaboard was represented by Clarence's father, old Judge Boswell. And Judge Boswell was a character. Oh, I mean the old bar, they were characters. I think maybe I put it in the record. When I came here, there was Wilson and Bobby. And Wilson was Solon Wilson. And he had daughters. Solon Wilson. And Clarence Boswell. Judge Boswell had been county judge way back there before my time. He worked for a railway company, and he suffered an injury. He was more or less crippled. And he loved his boots. I guess that's what Clarence, he's always a teetotaler, but oh, he was quite a character. And he in the main did criminal law practice. Most of his practice was criminal law practice. Then, and when Holland brought Bish Edwards here from Birmingham, and Edwards was a good lawyer, was a good trial lawyer, and was quite a competent public speaker, but Booz whipped him. And then Holland finally got rid of him. And then he formed a partnership for a while with Fred Harris. And he did in the main criminal law practice. The practice went down in certain channels. Judge Boswell did criminal. Most of all your criminal practice was dope was unknown. Shine was a big deal. See, it was during Prohibition. And there was hog cases, but most of them, your criminal cases you made money out of were your bootlegging cases, your shine cases, and 90% of them were repeaters. Well, as I said, I did a criminal practice. I did it all. I did it all. If you come in the door and you had a legitimate case, I was your lawyer. And that's the way you practiced law in those days. The country lawyer was akin to the country doctor. The brain no longer exists. All right? Then, well, I went in one day. In the meantime, I'd started doing civil law practice, mostly personal injury. There was no insurance much on automobiles. It wasn't compulsory. The workers' compensation law hadn't been passed. You were suing people didn't have insurance on cars. You were suing railroad wrecks, mostly your trains and your phosphate company. Your criminal practice was little, and it was repeat. I'd come down to the office about 7:30 of the morning, and there'd be three or four bums sitting waiting for me at the foot of the stairs. All right, and I'd start talking to them, and I'd be talking to somebody all day long. A lot of it didn't amount to anything. So anyway, I remember I went into Hufker one time and I said, I was doing a trial. Hufker, I don't think Hufker ever went to court after I started practicing law, because he didn't like practicing law. He was, I think he appreciated his limitations. Anyway, I went and I said, Mr. Hufker, I'm going to quit doing trial practice. I said, the first thing you know, they'll be calling me Judge Boswell. This, I think, was before Bish Edwards started taking. Oh, he says, we're making good money out of that. I said, yeah, but I can't do that and do all this other thing. Because Huffman wasn't doing it. He wasn't doing it. And he was supposed to do the chantry practice. But he wasn't doing it. He had always one of his girls working up here. He was playing golf 3 afternoons a week. He was spending a month in North Carolina. And I was toting the load. And I did for 18 years. Anyway, then I decided I wanted to keep some of the money that I was making, so I cut loose in May of 1940, and I would never have another practice. As I said, practice law in a big city, be a member of a firm. Practice law today, maybe you have to specialize. I ain't so sure to what the breed of lawyer. I don't do tax work. I quit doing that. I don't even attempt to do my own. It became specialized. Every time Congress and NEAT had passed new tax laws, and that became a study in itself. Labor law didn't used to exist. You have so many phases of the law today that when I went to law school, it didn't exist. There was no course in taxation. There was no course in taxation. What little I knew about taxation, and any high school graduate or less could do tax work in 1923. It just so happened that my dad was with Internal Revenue. And had been, if Internal Revenue in Illinois, and when he came to Florida, he thought he was rich, and then he went broke during the boom like everybody else. He went back to work as Deputy Collector of Internal Revenue working on the Lakeland. And what I knew, I picked up pretty much in talking to Dad, and of course I had took Prentice Hall and some, but it was elementary. But it's an entirely different. And you know, this public defender, gripes me. It drives me. It used to be, if a guy got in trouble, it was up to him to get him a lawyer. And you could always get somebody to represent him. When we were admitted to the bar, we were officers of the court. And it was our duty to represent anybody of crime. And if we got paid for it, fine. And if we didn't, it was up to us. If we represented him, it was up to us. And many a lawyer represented some guy maybe for 5 gallons of shine or maybe some pork, in the old days. And this public defender just gripes me. A guy goes up, he violates the law, and then the taxpayers have to pay for his defense. And I think it's fundamentally and basically wrong. That's another old man's idea.
Well, I think I agree with that.
Well, anyway, I know. I remember so well. Old John S. Edwards, when I came here, was a judge. He was judge of the circuit judge, the only judge in Polk County. You propose to take this and cover it, don't you? I mean, what are you going to do with this after you?
This tape and this information?
Yeah.
We're going to preserve it for the Polk County Historical Association.
Be all right. Well,
if there's anything you want to tell me that you don't want on tape, well, I won't put it on tape. The only reason I'm taping is so we'll have at least some preserved record.
Well, anyhow, yeah. I'm talking about, as I said, John S. Edwards was the circuit judge. And we had one court reporter. And the court reporter was Kate Faison. K-A-T-E-F-A-I-S-O-N, Kate Faison. She was a divorcee, and she had one son. And her son she was a secretary, or stenographer, we called her stenographer. She was stenographer for Carver and Langston. And Harden Peterson, it was Peterson and Carver. Then after that, it was Peterson, Carver, and Langston. That was Beauty Langston, the father of the two Langston boys. See, I knew them when they were kids, when Beauty came to Lakeland. And Beauty Langston was a good lawyer, excellent lawyer. Tedious, but an excellent lawyer. Hard worker. Peterson, of course, was a politician. Carver was an old bachelor. And the supposition was that he despised Katie's guts. She was a divorcee when she was working for Peterson and Carver. And I guess it's all right. Anyway, the upstart of the whole thing, much to the surprise of everybody, damned if Carver didn't marry Kitty. And she became Carver's wife. And he just recently died. Kate died suddenly, and then Carver married a younger woman, remember? Yeah, that's right. And he died not too long ago. Isn't that right? Well, anyway, Kate was quite a character. She was the code reporter. She and I were good friends. And I used to always say, and I don't know, I always said this, and I always did it. If a case is worth trying, it's worth reporting. And I never tried a lawsuit in my life but what I had a record. I don't know if you do that or not. But I used to say, if a case is worth trying, it's worth reporting, and I want a record. The court reporter would say to me, do you want to report this case? Of course, they knew me after a while. I'll get back now to the character of the practice. There were about 125 lawyers in Polk County. You knew everybody on a first name basis. And your practice in the main went through certain channels. You had two or three lawyers. You had a few lawyers who were doing the criminal practice. You had a few lawyers doing the civil practice. In Bartow, Luke Johnson and I were in the main, we were doing the civil practice, as long as Luke was doing the civil practice for then the firm of Wilson & Swearingen. They never went to court. They didn't like it. Neither one of them. I never knew Bradley Wilson and John Swearingen to try a lawsuit in their life.
Strictly office law.
They offered practice. They had a good clientele. They, in the main, had the phosphate business that Spencer Holland ordinarily afterwards inherited, and which became the backbone of the business for the firm locally of Holland & Knight. But they inherited that from Spencer Holland, and he got most of that after Wilson and Swearingen. And I didn't get it because I didn't have time and I didn't want it. I never represented a phosphate company. For instance, I represented, this is an interesting case. Talking about phosphate companies. Talking about trial practice. Elmer Burnett worked for a phosphate company. He was a chemist. He married Sloan's wife, S.P. James' daughter, Elmer Burnett. She's dead. Married her. Anyway, he was working for phosphate company. He was a chemist. He was working with gasoline. The gasoline exploded and burned him to death. I entered a suit in the circuit court. They removed the federal court for diversity of citizenship. I went down to Tampa and I got a verdict. $40,000. it was such a big verdict, it was headlines in the Tampa Tribune. $40,000 award from Amstead. They appealed it to the Supreme Court, I mean to the district, New Orleans. And they affirmed it, but made us enter a miniature down to $25,000. All right, how times have changed. Now they're allowing millions. We get back. In Polk County, there's maybe 125, 130 lawyers. We sound the dock twice a year. There might be 15 cases set for trial. I might have 8 or 9 of them. And then after we sounded the docket, we'd go someplace and we'd have a big meeting. We'd have 5 gallons of shine, food, and everybody and have a good time drinking corn liquor.
Judges and the lawyers?
Yeah, sure. Sure. We'd go to my place sometime at Crooked Lake. Sometimes we'd go to Brad Wilson's place. He had a place out at Crooked Lake. And we'd do it twice a year. And we'd have a bar meeting. We had a big time. And as I say, you knew everybody on a first name basis. Entirely different. And, of course, there wasn't any number of the trials that there are now. You might, if you look back there at the old dockets, you might have maybe 15 or 20 cases set for trial. Then there's one judge. Then John S. Edwards, as I said, during the boom when all the lawyers were making money, I don't remember now what the salary was. It wasn't very much. But lawyers generally were making more money. After the boom, when I was practicing law, I was shooting. People wonder what you made back in those days. I was shooting and made $50,000 gross a year. See, and that was a hell of a lot of money in those days. And I was paying Miss M. I was giving her 10. Yeah, I gave her 10% of the gross plus her regular salary. So she, Miss M, working for me. She worked harder than I did, and she was making more money than a lot of the lawyers in practicing law in Polk County. Yeah. She'd say to me, "Well, Colonel, I got to work tonight. I got to get that damn brief up," and so forth and so on. And here's another, bless her heart, she never used an IBM. She had the old Underwood. And she was a perfectionist on that Underwood. This is a bit of her history I'll preserve. She would never used with that one Underwood. And when it got where it wasn't functioning just right, she'd have it rebuilt. During World War II, I insisted on buying a new Underwood. That's sitting out there. And that's the one that I used. Anyway, I said, "Miss M, this IBM does real nice work. Let's try it." "I don't want it, Colonel." I said, "I insisted." So, she used it for a week. So I got an IBM up here. I'd hear Miss M out there hitting it and cussing. She come in the next Monday. She said, "Well, Colonel, that's a good typewriter. You ought to get you 2 or 3. But when you do, get you another stenographer." I said, "Miss M, that ain't that important. They used to say over the cover room that they could tell the work that she did, it was so perfect. And she hit it so hard she could make 4 or 5 carbons, you know." That was before the days of copy machines. Yeah. If you wanted copy, you had to make a copy. You never furnished your adversary. You didn't furnish your adversary with copies of your pleading. If he wanted your pleadings, he went and made copies of them. See, only for true courtesy you did. If the guy on the other side was nice and did that, you'd make him a copy. And most of your lawyers were your friends. I remember one time, to go like to illustrate, you wouldn't see this now. I was trying a case. Bob Shackelford was on the other side. And it was set for trial, and we went in, and I announced the plaintiff's ready, Your Honor. And Bob said, "The defendant's ready, court please." The old D.O. Rogers said, "No." He said, "Well, you gentlemen approach the bench." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You guys are good lawyers." He said, "I'll give you 30 minutes to settle this case." So you can settle it, dude. Bob and I went and settled. See, I got where I could put a value on a case. I could tell you pretty well whether or not I could win it. I could tell you whether or not I could win it. And if I didn't figure the chances were that I'd settle. I'd settle. If I felt I couldn't win it, I'd settle. And that's the way you practice law. And it was, you didn't have, well, I don't know, I haven't followed for a number of years because I quit going to court, but it's an entirely different profession.
Yeah. Well, I think, don't you think that's the makings of a good lawyer, to evaluate your case properly?
No question about it. No question about it.
That's what makes the difference in a lawyer and a good lawyer.
Yeah, well, anyway, then, another thing, now, I was on the committee that wrote the present rules of civil procedure. You know, we were told, I think it's the only committee that ever received a condemnation from the Supreme Court. I was on that committee, whenever it was. It was in the early 50s. So I was real active for 30 years. Then I slowed down. See, I got where I couldn't turn loose, and I was trying to do too much. I had a big crowd practice. I had a 10,000-acre ranch over on the East Coast, and Eisenhower put me on the federal board. And I had to do something. I got where I couldn't turn loose. I couldn't sleep at night. I used to walk down that old Fort Meade Road night after night. And so I was up in Hershey one time, and I was sick. I don't want this on. So I'm next on the 7th. The most unusual thing ever happened to you as a practicing attorney out of court, in court, where and when. I remember one time, this is a funny thing. To me, it's a funny thing. It's maybe a bit risque, but not too bad to be a matter of record. This is about the funniest thing that ever happened to me, and the biggest joke on me, and the thing that took the wind out of my sails more than anything else. One time, I sued, I don't know if he's related to you or not, he had the same name. I sued W.J. Durance. Is it W.J. or J.W.? He was county commissioner. Was it W.J.? His son is still in Fort Meade. Katie Durance's husband.
Yeah, that was W.J.
W.J. Durance was county commissioner. W.J. Durance was county commissioner. Lived in Fort Meade. And he was Katie, Miss Katie's husband. And W.J., they call him W.J., his father. Is he related to you?
Yes, sir.
Well, don't make any difference. Here it goes. There was an old man by the name of Woods, who was a non-resident. He lived up in Ohio. And he had 10 acres of land out from Fort Meade. Had a fine stand of virgin pine timber on it. And he come down here, he came here infrequently, said he was a non-resident. He lived in Iowa. He was a farmer, Iowa farmer. Come here and went out there and best pat somebody had cut all his pine timber. So he inquired around and he found out that W.J. Durance had sold pine timber to somebody. I didn't know W.J. Durance at the time. I knew he was county commissioner. So he come in up here and wanted to know, would I sue a county commissioner? I said, yeah. I guess I'd sue my grandma if I thought she was. They all look alike to me. So I sued W.J. Durance for cutting old man Woods' timber. And Luke Johnson, he was the representative. He represented us. We're trying it before H.C. Pell. So anyway, I remember that I sued him for damages and punitive damages and smart money because he knowingly sold old man Woods' timber when he knew it wasn't good. And I wanted smart money or punitive damages. And I was explaining to the court the difference, kind of trespass. I said, now, Judge, on the one hand, we had trespass, day bonus aspertatus. On the one hand, on the other hand, we had trespass, cleric, cross, and frigate, which have different rules of damages and so forth. And I went on to expound at great length of different kinds of trespass. So after I had finished this exhaustive, technical, highly learned argument, old Luke Johnson got up and said, if the court please, I don't have the advantage of a good legal education as my learned young friend does. I'm not versed in Latin. He says, as a matter of fact, the only Latin I've ever learned and known of is that penis erectus, non conscientious. Well, yeah, that was an open court, see. And in all my years, I think that was the funniest thing that ever happened to me, and everybody burst out laughing, and I had to burst out laughing too. But old Uncle Luke, see, Uncle Luke, oh, pull that on me. He was a dear old fellow. His niece, Dorothy Balliet, grew up on Church Street, as did my first wife, Dorothy Johnston, and they were close friends. And after Dorothy and I were married in 1934, every night, she always called him Uncle Luke, every night, old Uncle Luke would show up at the house with a pint of whiskey, and he'd had a few snorts out of the time he got there, and he'd come out for dinner, wholly uninvited, but he came there practically every night. And if he didn't come out there and we weren't there, he was at it. He'd tell us about it. But the time that Dorothy would prepare, sometimes he would bring shrimp, sometimes he would bring steaks. But Dorothy, he always called her, she had a pet name for him. I can't remember. Anyway, she always called him Uncle Lou. And he'd eat a big meal. He'd finish the pint of liquor. And as soon as he'd eat, he'd say, well, sweet potato. Cold Dorothy sweet potato. Well, sweet potato, the old gobbler's got a fly up. He'd go out and get in his car and go home and go to bed. See? He was a character in this world. He was an old bachelor. He never married. He knew everybody in Polk County. He was a great trial lawyer of the old school, like the Abraham Lincolns and the Clarence Darrells. I knew Clarence Darrell in Chicago. He had an unmarked office up there, and I knew Clarence Darrell in the heyday. He was the great orator, the William Jennings Bryan. And I don't think they exist anymore. I don't think they exist anymore. The Pat Whitakers are gone. The Marshall Edwardses are gone. Okay. Of course, I never was as dramatic. I was never dramatic. Pat, probably. Pat was an actor. Pat Whitaker was a great actor.
I've heard stories of Pat Whitaker once.
See, Pat got clarity. He'd never take a case in Polk County unless they agreed to hire me, too. Because I made Pat's bullet. I remember one time, Pat was an alcoholic, you know. Well, how were criminal cases handled? Well, what's the funniest thing that ever happened to you as a practitioner? Worst thing? Oh, the worst thing, I remember the worst thing. I never forget this. I was trying a case one time in federal court in Tampa, and they took a recess, and I went to the men's room. That's when zippers first come out. I went in the men's room to relieve myself, as did the majority of people. And when I got through, I couldn't zip the zipper. The damn zipper stuck. And it just wouldn't zip for hell. So I had to finish the day out with, you know, my legs crossed, and conscious of the fact that my damn pants were unzipped. And for years after that, I used to buy my clothes from Head and Debtor, and for years after that I always insisted that they put buttons on the pants instead of zippers, and it must have been 10 years before I ever. Now that's the worst thing that ever happened to me, the most embarrassing, and that was the federal court in Tampa. How are criminal cases handled? And defendants have many rights? Sure, they had the same rights as they got now, but it was up to them to get their own lawyer. Plea negotiations were almost unheard of. They weren't unheard of. You had a case or you didn't. There wasn't much bargaining back in the old days. I'm talking about 50 years ago.
You think the so-called modern plea bargaining has damaged the criminal justice system?
I don't think there's any question about it. I think very definitely so. This just getting rid of it. Plea to go, what kind of sentences? Well, they varied, of course. I can't recall any particular instance. Any famous criminal trials? Yeah. There was perhaps the most famous one that I was in was the Earl Wirt murder case. You remember that, don't you?
Which one?
Earl Wirt murder case.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was in the 40s. It was not long before I quit doing trial work. Earl Wirt lived in Babson Park. This is a famous case. And Earl Wirt shot and killed a man by the name of Frazier, who was manager of the airport out here. This was in the 40s. It was during World War II. See, I remember that because Bradley Wilson was on the... I was under 45, subject to call, had no children, and Bradley Wilson was chairman of the draft committee, and Bradley was instrumental in hiring me. And I figured Bradley wasn't going to send me off to war as long as I defended old man Earl Wirt, who was his real close friend. and who Edna Earl was named after. All right, a bit of history. Earl Ward was president of the Old Polk County National Bank. He was the head of the bank. He was a banker, very prominent, big Mason, had been imperial potentate down in Tampa, was one time president of the Florida Citizens Exchange, and owned groves and lived in Babson Park. This was during the war years. He had a son, Earl Ward Jr., who took flying lessons out here and became a pilot after he went over to Italy. And his plane was out here. And when he left, he asked his father to sell the plane for him. Well, Tillis Edwards, who's the other Lakeland Edwards, no relation to mine, was out there taking flying instructions from Fraser, who was the instructor out there. And he went out and was interested in buying the plane. And when he got ready to buy the plane, Fraser told him he had a lien on it for gasoline that Olinger had purchased. That's Earl Wirt's daughter's husband. Elizabeth Beth Wirt married Olinger. And he was out there and had taken some flying lessons and bought some gasoline for this plane, and they left, I guess, to go overseas. The plane was out there. And Fraser wouldn't deliver the plane. He wouldn't let Tillis Edwards get it until his $32 bill was paid. All right, so Tillis Edwards calls up word at Babson Park, said Mr. Told the trouble he was having. Said, they won't let me pick up this plane out here that there's a lien on it for gas that your son-in-law owes Fraser for gas. And so Mr. Ward said, well, I don't know anything about it. He said, it's all news to me, but I'll come in and take it.